the Award Podcast is brought to you by Naked City Brewery.
Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 197 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Yes, indeed, folks. Holy smokes! Holy smokes, we've got a great show planned for you this week. Philip Peterson. The man, the myth, the legend. He is the bass player and lead singer and songwriter for the band Tennis Pro here in Seattle. He also plays cello and coordinates string sections and stuff for platinum-winning artists. He himself has, I think he says it in the interview. It's something like 4 platinum records and, 2 gold records. That's insane, right? We've got this guy here. He's going to be in the backyard joining us here shortly. But of course, first, you know, we'll do a little talking. Just you and me, right? I'll talk into your ear. You may respond. I won't hear you. Unless you email me, Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, at error-raid.net. You can keep in touch with us there and on Twitter and on Facebook, at airraidnet. We love hearing from you guys, so keep that up. We've been getting a lot of good feedback from listeners around the world, man. It's been pretty great. I'm going to hold off on reading emails in this episode, though. Maybe we'll do that again next week. So some people seem to enjoy it, some people not so much. It can seem like a little bit of a egotistical, roller coaster ride, right? Yeah, so we don't want to take you down that road each week. But we will, we'll continue to read your emails and play some of your voicemails, too. I think we got a couple of those in the, some real old ones, too. Anyway, let's get down to it, right? I went to see Godzilla last night with a good bud of mine, Kevin Sir, who's been on this show a couple times. He runs things over at Artist Home here in Seattle and puts together Timber Fest and Dobe Fest. And all these music festivals, these great, in the woods, kind of small music festivals here, in the Western Washington area. And he's just a great dude. And we went to go see Godzilla last night. By the way, pretty good movie. Pretty good movie, man. Special effects were pretty rad. The visuals were amazing. Great 3D on that IMAX screen that we saw it on. It was pretty fun. It was a fun movie. Second half of the movie, I don't know. I don't know. I didn't dig the storyline, but like I said, the special effects were amazing. Anyway, we went out for a couple drinks before. Yeah, that's right. We did that. It was a mandate. It was a mandate. Play on words, right? Kind of. Sort of. Maybe I don't know the meaning of that play on words phrase. I don't know. But anyway, we had a great time, and it was a lot of fun. We had some drinks, and then we started talking about World War II and Vietnam and the amazing documentaries and why we're obsessed with that stuff. And I do not know why I am obsessed with war documentaries, but holy shit, just talking about it with Kevin last night sent me on this whole thing today where I just watched Ken Burns' The War, right? It's this amazing documentary. Each episode, there's 7 episodes in this amazing documentary. They're about two hours long each, and I watched 2 of them today. That's how much time I have on my hands, people. My wonderful wife took both girls out to this birthday party. Don't judge me because I didn't go. I went to the same birthday party last night. Now they were doing this other thing today. It was. I was not the only dad that did not show up to that birthday party today. Trust me, okay? All right. So now that we got that out of the way. But yeah, I don't know why. I don't know why I'm obsessed with World War II. I can't. I mean, I can't get away from it. And it seems like the older that I get, the easier it is to kind of fall back into just like watching documentaries about it. Because like I would go, in my younger years, I would go months and months without having to watch it. I'm an addict. I'm an addict, people. This is what an addict does, right? We recount tales. But I would go months. I would go months without watching a World War II documentary. This sounds so just stupid and weird. But then something would trigger it, right? I'd see a World War II movie, like motion picture, and then I'd have to go and just watch a whole bunch of documentary films about it. And now we're talking about it last night, and I just had to do it. And he was telling me all these documentaries that I hadn't seen yet. There's another one called World War II in HD that the History Channel did, and I bought that on Amazon today. And then I bought Vietnam in HD on Amazon today. I've got a problem, people. I've got a big problem, and man, I don't know what I'm going to do about it. Maybe this is filling the void. I'm quitting smoking again. Maybe this is filling the void that nicotine is taking up in my life, right? Something to think about. Chew on that, folks, for a little bit. Things on the home front going pretty well. Got to tell you, I'm doing well. My family is doing well. My little baby daughter is sleeping through the night, mostly, kind of. And things are normalizing over here. That's right, man. Things are normalizing. It's getting good. I'm digging it. We've been having some great weather here in Seattle, and it's just been awesome. But like a normal Seattleite or Western Washingtonite, it just doesn't happen in Seattle, folks. But yeah, I kind of want the rain to come back a little bit. I want it to water my yard, my flowers. Take care of that shit. I don't want to pay for it. Back on this World War II thing, I did have a thought about this. I'm kind of all over the place, but watching this stuff, watching what these people went through, seeing the footage of the actual war and these battles going on in the Pacific and over on the Eastern Front. I mean, God damn it, man! These people went through some real shit. These people went through some real, real shit, man. And like just hearing them talk about it and watching them tear up while they recount these tales of battle is just really, really intense. Maybe that's partly why I like it. I don't know. Because it's super real emotion, right? It gets you right in your heart. And it just pierces you, right? Yeah. It pierces your soul because that is fucking real, right? Sorry, I'm swearing so much. But there's been so much stuff lately on the internet that has really been pissing me off. And, I'd love to hear your feedback on this, folks. Remember, you can email me, aaron@air-raid.net. But there's been this stuff like, this is just one of them. I think it was like 210 women were kidnapped. God, what country was it? I can't remember now. This is bad. Now I feel stupid. But they were kidnapped. By this Islamic terrorist group. And I'm sure we've all heard of this, right? And then, so as this campaign was started with these, famous people, one of which being, the guy from NSYNC, Justin Timberlake, one of which being Justin Timberlake holding a sign that said, real men don't, steal women or don't kidnap women. Something to that effect, right? And so this whole, big controversy kind of bubbled up about the use of the term real men, a real man, right? And I read a couple articles on it from the feminist perspective. They've got some good points in there. But I felt like it was, let's not waste our time on that. Like, that's, what is that? What is that? In the terms of like what's going on in that actual situation where there are 210 women, young girls that are being sold off into slavery and into, marriages for like $5, man. That is some serious shit. This brings me back to World War II. fuck. Nobody was like, you know, complaining about the use of verbiage, right, back then. Well, they probably were. They probably were. This has been going on forever. It's just more in your face, right? Because it's on the internet and you're constantly looking at it on your Facebook stream. But man, God dang it, man. It really just aggravated me. Especially when I started watching the World War II stuff, because it would just seem so antiquated and so like so meaningless, right? These arguments, they're just so meaningless. They feel like it anyway. I mean, I guess, you know, God, I grew up a white male, right? Kid, child of privilege. Although I will say, you know, yes, my life was probably easier than a lot of others. I was not homeless. I was addicted to drugs very heavily for a certain amount of time, which I don't care to really get into too much on this show, but maybe we will. I also had a brother that was terminally ill, right, for most of his life. And you know, we didn't grow up rich. We didn't grow up rich. My parents did all right for themselves, and as I got older, they started doing better. But I also suffered from depression and anxiety and things like that, and that is a normal human thing to go through, right? Everybody has that. No matter you're black, white, you know, Japanese, you're from Asia, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Man, fuck. We've got so much shit going on in the world, and we're complaining about verbiage that people use in an ad campaign. I tweeted the other day. Man, this is running long. I gotta cut this off. I tweeted the other day. We should spend more time as a people getting pissed off at ad campaigns. People thought I was being serious. I was not. We need. So the next thing we need is like everybody's saying, a sarcasm font on Twitter. That would help out quite a bit. Or I could have just used a hashtag. Hey. You guys remember, we get a sponsorship from the good people over at Naked City Brewery, right? Man, great food, great beer. Go visit them. Greenwood Avenue North, 8564 Greenwood Avenue North here in North Seattle. Man, that place is just great. And the dudes that run it, Brian and Dan, or Don, I'm sorry. Whoa, shit, man. I'll have to cut that out. Brian and Don, great dudes. Man, they really know their beer, and the people that they've got cooking for them in the kitchen really know their food. You guys really, you gotta go and visit this place. Great, great people, great ambiance in there. Yeah, it's a good place. It's a good place, and they're doing all sorts of stuff now. They're doing these Naked City music nights in conjunction with a band in Seattle, this local television show. It's called Naked Sessions, man. They just had Big Sur in there. The next one, I don't know. The next one, it's gonna be soon. So keep your eyes peeled. Go to nakedcitybrewing.com. Wow. If they hear this, man, they're severing ties real quick. Let me tell you. Wednesday the 28th, they've got Jazz in the Walrus Beer Garden, May 28th. 7 p.m. Go and check it out if you're here in Seattle. If you're not, if you don't live in Seattle, if you ever come and visit, come and visit there, because 9 times out of 10, I will be there drinking beer and eating a burger. If I'm not, you know, whatever, get some good beer. That's all there is to it, right? But you can also like them on Facebook and do all that stuff. Tell them that you heard about them from the Air Raid podcast, because that helps us out. That helps them out. And, you know, that's what we're about here, right? We're about helping each other out, man. Helping your fellow man or person. I should say person. Helping your fellow person, right? We don't want to get in trouble with that. All right. Hey, this movie, Big in Japan, Philip Peterson stars in it. It's about his band that we're going to talk about here real quick, Tennis Pro. I had the pleasure of checking this movie out. They sent me a screener. Tennis Pro sent me a screener, and it is fucking so good. I was blown away by it and super, super impressed. And I urge all of you who can, go and see it. June 5th, Thursday, June 5th, 7 p.m. at the Egyptian Theater here in Seattle as part of the Seattle International Film Festival, SIFF. Tennis Pro will be playing this movie for you guys. And they'll also be playing a concert right afterwards. So, man, make sure to check that out. June 5th at the Egyptian Theater. Get your tickets now. And you can like Big in Japan on Facebook, and you can also like Tennis Pro on Facebook, right? Yeah, that's good things. A lot of plugs in this episode, right? One more. Go to our archives page. You remember our archives page over there at air-raid.net. You can find all the past episodes of the Air Raid podcast there, all 197 episodes, up there for your listening pleasure. Or you can find them on iTunes and cairoradio.com. They're nice enough to host our stiff over there. But episodes with people like Bob Saget, Jim Brewer from SNL, Macklemore, come on, Nacho Picasso. Man, we've had a lot of great people on this show. Mike Birbiglia, Mudhoney, Mark Arm from Mudhoney, Chris Walla of Death Cab for Cutie. Man, that was a good conversation, wasn't it? Yeah, it's all there, all free, all the time at air-raid.net. Click on the archives page. You can check it all out. Damian Jurado, man. Yeah. David Bazan, John Roderick, John Richards from KEXP is up there too. That was a really good episode there. Yeah, you can check it all out. Yeah, do that. All right. Enough whispering into your ear. I have gone on far enough. This song is called Kimberly by Tennis Pro, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears. Stay with us. I don't know. They look like peanut butter. Maybe that's ones. What I was going for.
Yeah.
You played the old Comet?
Well, yeah. I mean, who hasn't,
right? Yeah. I only played it once, and it was like a big deal too. Like we were so stoked.
And was it good?
No, it was awful. The sound was terrible. We were shitty drunk. And it was like, it was Tuesday at like 12, you know, it just sucked. But we were it was just like, yeah, it's the Comet. So we all thought, you know, that was going to be the big break.
It can be fun. It can be really fun to play.
Yeah. Well, every other band that I've seen there has played to a full house.
Sure. Which didn't take a whole lot to do, but.
No.
I don't know if I've ever played it without being totally terribly drunk too, so.
Philip Peterson joining me in the backyard. Welcome, sir. Thank you so much for coming out on a weekday.
No problem.
I appreciate it. Yeah. Taking time out of your busy, busy schedule, right?
Yeah, I'm actually pretty busy this week, but yeah.
well, good. You've got this, you're the bass player and singer and songwriter for the band Tennis Pro here in Seattle.
Yeah.
You guys have got this movie that's coming out, called Tennis Pro,
right? Or Big in Japan. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Big in Japan.
Yeah, yeah. Which is fantastic. You were nice enough to send me a screener of this film, and my wife and I sat down and watched it, and it was so good. Like I really didn't know what to expect. I've seen your band play live before.
Oh, cool.
And enjoyed it, and I didn't know it was kind of, not to say that your band is tongue in cheek, but there's like this mythology or story behind it, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So why don't you clue us into this? Tell us about like what's the story behind the band, and then going into like Big in Japan, the movie. Well, how do they intertwine?
You mean how did we kind of get into the idea of going for this movie thing?
Sure. Or yeah. Like, yeah.
Well, I mean, we first started in 2003, and we decided that there wasn't enough happy, fun, danceable music that, you know, made girls want to take their shirts off and get wild. And it was just sort of in this world of Seattle being this really sad folk singery thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And we kind of figured that that was a little phase that Seattle was going through and would grow out of.
Yeah.
I think everybody was still really sad that Kurt Cobain was dead and stuff.
In 2003.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we were like, let's make, you know, some music that cheers people up and is happy and is fun. And I mean, to me, rock and roll should be rebellious and danceable and loud, not serious and artistic as much. I mean, it's up to the audience to decide whether it's an art or not. I just feel like if you're banging on stuff and plugging in noisemakers, you should have fun and not take yourself too seriously.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the philosophy that sparked this idea of Tennis Pro, which is kind of a dig on country club culture. And it's also sort of the Tennis Pro is the guy that's sleeping with the rich dude's wife and on the sly. And he's also kind of this McEnroe Agassi kind of punk thing.
Yeah,
so we've found it kind of this clever, to us at least, idea of like the punk kids crashing the country club and
sure
playing rock and roll and making all the,
so there is like a persona associated with being in the band Tennis Pro then, right?
Yeah, to some degree. Yeah,
because I've seen you on stage, and like looking across this table at you right now, you're very quiet, you're very reserved. You're calculated in what you want to say, which I can tell. But on stage, you are like this rock and roll guy persona.
Cool.
Right?
That's awesome to hear.
You are the Tennis Pro. You are the guy sleeping with the rich guy's wife.
Right.
I love that. That's great. That's great. So you guys have been, you've been a band for 11 years, same lineup.
Same exact three-piece. We're a trinity or a trifecta.
So to speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
With David Drury. We've had his wonderful wife, Stephanie, on the show before. And then what's the drummer's name again?
Sean Lowry.
Sean Lowry. Okay. Great. Great. So what was the impetus for this film?
Well, in 2009... I had just worked on this thing called $5 Cover that Lynn Shelton did here in Seattle.
Yeah, we talked to Lynn right after that came out.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I played this tiny bit part of the guy producing the Emergencies record. So I'm in it for just like a split second.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, I had met all these people and they filmed in my house. So we got, you know, pretty well acquainted during that point, and I met John Jeffcoat and Lynn Shelton and the producer Jane Charles, who ended up living really nearby.
Yeah.
And so we kind of became friends as neighbors too. So that was kind of happening in that I kind of had this taste of like, oh wow, there's kind of this film thing that's going on. And meanwhile, Tennis Pro didn't really have any music videos or any online presence. And at that point it was becoming very apparent that YouTube is now the jukebox that people use to discover music. And so if you're not really on YouTube, you don't exist.
Yeah.
So good luck with that.
Right.
So became very apparent, like, hey, we need video, we need content, we need to be online, we need a presence, otherwise we just don't exist. And we already kind of felt like we didn't exist already, because, you know, we had been a band for several years, and sort of, you know, nothing had really happened as far as, you know, this myth of being discovered or whatever.
Right,
which
right.
Now it realizes is just, you know, a myth that the industry perpetuates.
Oh, sure,
but
sure.
Don't tell anybody.
It's definitely different now. Like, yeah. There is, that doesn't really exist anymore.
Well,
right?
I don't know if it ever has. I think that's just kind of like a Disney fairy princess thing that
you mean not you having to kids. Work for it?
No, is just the idea of being discovered.
Okay.
I don't think that's ever happened. So, you know, there's stories of somebody singing in a gas station and somebody heard them or whatever. But then it turns out behind the scenes that, you know, this artist was being developed for a long time.
Yeah. What about Jeff Beck, though? Jeff Beck was a guitar player for the Byrds that was like, wasn't he discovered like just playing guitar like in his, and this may be one of those mythological stories, who knows, but he was like an auto mechanic, the story goes. And he was just playing guitar on his, like, lunch break.
That's a great story.
And some producer was just like, hey, the Byrds need another, or the Yardbirds, one of those bands, you know, one of those old 60s bands that had a roving different players. It was the same one, like, Clapton started out in and stuff, too, you're right.
Yeah.
I think it was the Byrds.
Well, maybe. But, I mean, I don't know of it happening to anyone in my lifetime.
Right, right.
But... so, you know, we were sort of getting frustrated with that kind of thing of like, why, you know, what, nothing's happening here. But like, we keep making records, we keep playing shows, and we just sort of seem to keep like playing this at the same level.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there was kind of that frustration and that led to the idea of like, let's get the hell out of Seattle. Let's go to Tokyo.
And what year is this?
This was 09.
09, okay.
And so I was telling my drummer in a road trip to Portland that we were playing a show down there. And I was like, hey, there's two things that we have to do or we're just wasting our time. Number one, we have to film ourselves. We have to make music videos.
Yeah.
We have to do something.
Yeah.
And then number two, Seattle's not our market. We have to go to Tokyo. We have to get the hell out of here. We have to go to where I think people are going to really like our music in Tokyo.
So that's truth right there.
Oh, that's totally true.
That's truth in the, excuse me. I keep on fiddling with the audio over here.
That's fine.
So that's kind of a true thing that happens in the movie and that happened in real life.
Yes. Then. It's all true. And, it all is true, and we knew it, you know, and Drury wrote a song in one of our earlier songs called Rock Over Tokyo.
Yeah.
So this idea of what it would be like when we go to Tokyo and, you know, achieve our, you know, destiny. And
your rock and roll dreams.
Yeah, and it was sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy because now it's all happening, you know, slowly but surely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so then Sean was like, well, man, why don't we film ourselves just going to Tokyo with no shows set up, with nothing. Let's just like go and let's like do a reality show of us in Tokyo, just playing on the street or getting attention or just trying to do whatever we can, make some connection or whatever.
Yeah.
We're bound to get at least a show if we're these Americans. We're going to stick out. So, which of course, then I was like, oh, that's a great idea. Cause I'm all about crazy ideas.
Yeah.
And he was like, dude, it's called Big in Japan. Let's just make this TV show basically. And that was sort of more than just a crazy idea because we already knew some of these people that were involved with $5 Cover.
Mm-hmm.
So we immediately pitched the idea to Jane Charles, the producer of $5 Cover, and she loved it. And she got John Jeffcoat on board who did the Amplified Docs in relation to the $5 cover as well.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So I had met him already, and he'd been to my house, and so it was kind of a natural progression, and we got him on board, and the more the idea developed, it became less of a reality of us just being crazy weirdos in Tokyo, and more like a scripted reality series or feature film.
Yeah,
and just
yeah.
The longer it went, the more it just kind of organically was like, this is a movie.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So
it's basically a feature film. I mean, there's a plot, it's funny.
It's a narrative.
Yeah.
It's a fictionalized account of a real band doing something for real.
Yeah.
With us really playing our songs and us using our own names and our own spouses and that kind of thing.
So when you guys, had you gone to Japan then before the movie was made or
no.
Did you? Okay.
We first raised money on Kickstarter to go over there with no script or anything and just filmed and played like 9 shows in like 14 days and filmed a lot of playing shows, a lot of music, a lot of rock stuff, and caught some crazy incidental material that was real.
Yeah.
That was really happening, like the ice cream truck scene and some of the other things. That's real.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and there's a few other things that ended up getting caught on film. And then we were trying our hand at, there was a couple little things that were kind of inside jokes that we were like, well, let's film ourselves kind of playing this out and see what that looks like. And
yeah. So how scripted was it then? I mean, was it a lot? It seems like a lot was left up to improv.
Well, the first trip we went was not scripted.
Oh, okay.
And then we went back a second time with no cameras to just play rock and roll.
Okay.
And that was during around the time of the earthquake stuff. And then we went back a third time with a script and actually didn't play any shows and just were there working really hard trying to be actors and spell out the narrative basically what's a fairly true story.
Yeah.
Some of the things are not true and some of the things are enhanced. And
oh, sure.
One of the things happened to me in a different band. So it's like true, but it never happened in Tennis Pro and it happened like 15 years ago. So
I'll ask you about that off air. Cause I don't want to spoil it.
Well, I don't
want to
spoil it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
but I think you know which part it might be.
I think I might know as well.
Yeah.
It was just, it just was super great. The first scene, are we spoiling anything if we just tell people what the first scene is?
I mean, I don't know.
The opening scene of this movie is you playing the bass on the toilet. And it's fantastic because, and it really, it made me laugh so hard because I was like, how many times have I been on the toilet playing the guitar?
That's
a
funny,
billion.
Because I don't know if I ever really have.
Oh,
that
really?
Was actually fictional.
Oh, no. Because you get the best, that's the best acoustics in the bathroom.
No, no. Singing, yes. Singing,
okay,
yes.
Okay, okay.
I don't really like take sheet music to the toilet.
Well, no, of course not. Of course not. But I have had, like, especially in college, like we had, my roommate was a musician as well. And like, he just would set up a guitar stand in the bathroom because, you know, when you go in there and you've got some business to
do. That's kind of a good idea, really.
You know,
yeah.
You know, this was before Sudoku, so it made its way over here. So, you know, he just played a little Martin Mountain guitar in there and passed the time.
Awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Totally.
Well, that's
totally.
One of the things that I guess, you know, John Jeffcoat did such a good job at doing a lot of the scripted elements in that they are very relatable and they're very believable.
Yeah.
In that aspect.
Yeah, yeah.
Despite the fact that there are no real actors in the movie except for two actors from a different industry.
Right, right. it came across real well. The movie was so much fun to watch. And you know, part of it was like, I'm like two people removed from you guys, you know, and so it was kind of cool to see you guys over there doing your thing. So you did say like there are parts of this movie where you're like out in a park and you just set up out in this park, and you were talking about this a little bit earlier, like, you just did that.
Yeah.
And there are scenes where, like, cops come over and tell you to shut it down. That was obviously real.
Yeah, right? I mean, that was real. We didn't necessarily know that the cops were going to come and shut us down, but we kind of knew that that might happen, so we were sort of, you know, it's definitely, like, a gray area between... Those are the parts that are definitely a gray area between whether that's real or scripted or
What were the difficulties filming those types of scenes in public? It has to be kind of difficult with, like, day-to-day life is still going on around you, and you've got a camera pointed in your general direction, and you're trying to act.
Yeah, well, one of the things that made it amazing was that they were shooting it on, like, 5D and 60D cameras.
Okay.
So
it just looked like tourists.
Yeah, like. John kind of just looked like this tourist that was just whatever. And we kind of stuck out, of course, because we're wearing weird stuff and, you know, kind of making, you know, buffoons of ourselves. Uh-huh. So we kind of took the heat, and people didn't really notice as much that it was a film happening in those public settings.
Were you nervous about that at all? Did it make you uncomfortable?
Well, the first trip was pretty fueled by alcohol as far as giving us liquid courage. And by the third trip over there and doing also some Seattle scenes, we kind of got used to the fact that the camera was there, and we didn't get as nervous.
Excellent. So. Let's do this. Let's go with our first musical break, or our second musical break. God, why do I always do that? I've been doing this show for 4 years, and every time I say, let's do this, let's go to our musical break, I always say first musical break. It should be second musical break.
Oh.
Just letting you know.
Cool.
Letting you in, Phil.
All right.
Opening my heart to you, sir. Now I'm making things really awkward. We'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Stay with us, everybody.
I broke a few American hearts, but still I think it's safe to say, got no baggage except for what I kept in the gate. Here I come to Japan, a record in my hand, looking for my future great fans. A common scream and shout, that's what it's all about. It's rock and send a sweet hello to the future Mrs. Tennis Pro. I wanna know if it's alright. On
it's all about. Come on, scream and shout. That's what it's all about. Come on, scream and shout.
Shochu? Shochu. It's kind of like a mix between vodka and sake.
Yeah.
They age it in these clay pots, and so it's sort of like a wine or something in that way, in that the different ages of it have a different quality.
Really? So it's like bourbon here, where it would just be like a barrel aged or something like that.
And it's made out of either rice or potato or wheat.
Okay.
It's
okay.
Any of those three.
Yeah. So does it actually make you hallucinate?
No, but there was a couple, nights where people got pretty crazy on it, and we blamed it wasn't kind of regular drunk. It was like crazy weirdo drunk. So,
that's a great scene, by the way. So when is this movie going to become available? When can people see it? All that good stuff.
It's going to play at the Egyptian on June 5th.
As part of SIFF?
As part of SIFF.
Okay.
At 7 o'clock. And then we're playing a live show at the Chop Suey right after that.
Oh, awesome.
So you can walk to the Chop and hear the band play right after you...
Right around the corner.
...saw the movie about the band.
Yeah. That is great, man. Are you pretty excited about the showing and
I am.
Everything?
Yeah.
It showed pretty well over in... South by Southwest, right?
Yeah,
it
was
took it over with
very
you.
Well received in Austin.
Yeah. So that's got to be pretty exciting.
It was. Yeah.
Tell me what
really
that feels
cool.
like, because like you said earlier, like you guys have been a band for 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
You've been kind of making or waiting to kind of not break it, but, you know,
gain an audience.
Gain an audience, you know, gain
have
something.
Have people care.
City and now that it's finally coming to fruition a bit, like, are you happy about that, or are you jaded?
No, I'm very happy about it.
Yeah,
it's good. It's cool to see just the thing kind of the snowball rolling down the hill.
Yeah,
collecting, getting bigger and faster.
Yeah.
So
kind of exciting.
It's very exciting.
Yeah.
It's very fulfilling.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. So I would highly recommend going and seeing this film. See it at SIFF, see it on the big screen, and then go and check you guys out at Chop Suey. I did want to, I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about yourself, Phil, because you're in this rock band, but you're also a producer. And you've done some pretty great things. You're also a cello player. You play with Chaprice, who we just had on the show, who's just a lovely person and an amazing talent. You've recorded with like Pink and stars like that, Aesop Rocky.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty insane. Like you've done string arrangements for those types as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been a cellist my whole life. My folks started me when I was 3. And so as a teenager, I would go play recording sessions, like particularly like Robert Lang. I was there, you know, like 20 years ago.
Robert Lang Studios?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And other places around town. And I always just really liked being in the studio. And meanwhile, I was... playing, you know, string quartets for weddings and doing that kind of, you know, symphony and starting to write and compose on for kind of a symphonic thing and chamber type stuff just as kind of a hobby.
Yeah.
And then also in the recording studio and figuring out like, oh, if I layer, you know, 40 of me, it sounds like a big string section. So like, that's cool. And so both of those worlds started to kind of like feed each other.
Yeah.
And, people started having me come in to be the crazy cello guy. And, I played on a ton of records, in town. And it was kind of fun. When I was in college, it was at a time where there weren't string players that could just play by ear.
Right.
That was like super rare. So
Where'd you go to college?
SPU.
Oh, okay.
So like I would get all the gigs because there wasn't anybody else in town that could play in tune.
Well, and probably not a lot of people that were doing it for like rock bands. Right.
Well, and the people that were doing it for the rock bands sounded like a rock person. They weren't really as classically professionally trained.
Right, right.
And then the people that were classical were like, well, what am I going to do? I need sheet music. And the rock people didn't know how to write sheet music. Uh-huh. So it sort of ended up being kind of this interpreter. And I still do a lot of that where like the Seattle Symphony will call me and have some pop artist or rock artist that they need arranging for. And I'll listen to their stuff and translate it onto paper for the symphony to play. And
yeah.
So that's always really a fun thing, kind of being an interpreter.
Wow.
So
that's insane.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and now it's really common for string people to be in bands, but it was kind of a weird anomaly at one point. So it was kind of a lucky timing that I kind of was able to get my name out there by being that guy.
Oh, that's great. And do you have your own studio space too that you're able to do all this stuff in?
I do. I just have a microphone, a really nice mic and in my room kind of like this with high ceilings and I just play. I just overdub, and I have my sister is a killer violinist.
Oh, nice.
And also Daniel, who plays with Chaprice. Those are kind of my two main violin people, and I have them come in and fill out the parts that I don't play and kind of go from there. So we'll build a 120-piece orchestra out of two people.
Oh, my God.
And it's really fun. Right now I'm working for Maroon 5, and it's a pretty epic.
What?
Yeah. It's pretty epic. And and I just did some stuff for PBS via The New Blank, who's a really amazing animating and graphic. And they did the title and end credits for our movie.
Wow.
So.
Oh, that's cool, man. And you, obviously, this is your job, right?
Yeah. So my day job is mostly doing string arranging. And I also like to produce, so I've done a lot of local stuff, like, of course, all the Tennis Pro records.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I did KK and His Weathered Underground and Portugal the Man and Wild Orchid Children. I did some.
Yeah.
And some other things, The Emergency.
Yeah.
So.
That's great. That's great. And so it's fun. It's kind of funny to hear you talk about this because on one side you have this amazing job where you are kind of like, you're kind of like in that film, 20 Feet from Stardom, right?
Yeah.
Where you're like the background guy that's making everything work. And then you've got this band Tennis Pro that you want to make work and it's now just finally working.
Yeah.
But have you ever thought about that? Like the dichotomy between the two there?
Absolutely. Yeah. And at some point it was very frustrating, that dichotomy. And now, more in hindsight, it's like, it makes perfect sense why those things exist and the timing of everything.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Totally. You know? Totally. So, well, now you're doing this thing with Chaprice.
Yeah.
And you're part of basically her band.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How has that been so far?
Well, she's just such an amazing artist and such a great person. Mm-hmm. So I was writing some stuff to pitch to big artists. Uh-huh. And so I was having her come in and sing kind of demo stuff. And then in trade, I was doing some arranging for her solo project that she was working on.
Yeah.
And then that just sort of ended up being like, well, why am I pitching stuff to some so-and-so who may or may not want it? Why don't I just pitch stuff to you? You're singing on it anyway. And then why don't I just be in your band? And so it just sort of became this organic, like, well, this is dumb that we're trading. Let's just be in a band. Like,
yeah.
Let's just do this.
Well, and she was saying too, like, it was great finding you because everything, like, it sounds like everybody that's playing with you guys in that just clicks.
Oh yeah,
for some reason
it's crazy chemistry.
IG88 and then the other
Daniel,
the other two string players that you got, everything is just working so well. Does your sister play in that one too?
No.
Okay.
It's just Daniel and I. Gotcha. But yeah, I use her for a lot of Victoria Parker. I use her for a lot of arranging work that I do.
So. That's pretty cool, man. That's really cool. So wait, you said you've been playing cello since you were three?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well,
a cello is a big instrument.
Like, well, they come in small sizes.
they got little children?
Yeah.
Children cellos?
Yeah.
Was this something that your parents like pushed you into?
Well, I wouldn't say it was a push, but you know, when you grow up and everyone that you know is a classical musician, you're the weirdo for not playing something.
So your parents are classical musicians as well?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So you were like, you were in it.
Yeah. It's like you would come over to my house and it'd be like, well, what instrument do you play? You know?
And if you didn't, you were the mailman or something.
Yeah,
right?
Well, it's if you didn't, then it's like, well, what do you give Jesus for his birthday?
So know, fairly religious household as well.
Well, they kind of go hand in hand.
Do they really? Classical musicians?
Not classical, but families who play music and religion kind of... That's kind of a vehicle
for it. Okay, you know? Okay. So what was it like growing up in a household like that then?
It was great.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was awesome. For me, it was awesome.
It sounds like, I mean, you haven't given up playing the cello, so you must have liked it.
Well, it's one of those things where I'm just fortunate because I'm actually wired to be a musician, whether or not I grew up in that environment. So it's like, that's cool. You know, I was kind of born to do it.
Yeah.
And then I just also was lucky enough to be born into, you know, that world where there was opportunity.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And lucky enough to play an instrument that was kind of considered kind of cool in the 90s and then that kind of thing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Did your parents like teach you how to play then or?
My mom started me. She's an incredible violinist. So
oh, cool.
I actually still hire her to work on arranging stuff.
So. Really?
Yeah.
Is that ever weird? Hiring your mother to do work?
It was kind of rad the first few times. I was like, yeah, I'm hiring you. Yeah, I'm your boss.
I'm your boss now.
You know, but it's not weird now because we work together all the time. Like, I actually go and my kids are in my folks' youth symphony that they conduct in Mount Vernon.
Cool. Oh, wow.
So I drive up there once a week and bring my kids to be in the symphony. And then I help coach and give lessons and like kind of try to help their orchestra.
Wow. So your mom plays violin.
Mm-hmm. And my dad's a killer trumpet player.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh,
very
man,
classical.
I always wanted to learn how to play the trumpet.
Yeah. He's like the killer, like Handel's Messiah trumpet player.
Really?
Like that really bright Baroque. Yes. Perfect crystal clear tone.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
oh my God, I borrowed a trumpet for a little while, and like everything that I do, if I can't figure it out in like 8 days, it's over. It's dead to me.
Yeah,
right?
and then
it just sits in a corner.
Oh man, I know, I know it too. I've got plenty of toys that I'm like not very good at.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, if I need four notes on a piano part or, you know, one guitar chord, that's not really, you know, I don't have to be the world's best player to, you know, honk a few notes on the trumpet or whatever.
Well, and being in the digital age, too, where everybody can have a home studio like this one, it makes that very easy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
So when did like... getting into production and getting into doing music, when did that kind of come into play for you? Like, well, doing music as like a professional gig?
I mean, when we were kids, we would play like a dinner theater and make bank.
Really?
Yeah. So like, and my folks were really careful about not like trying to take advantage of us.
Mm-hmm.
So like they would pay us really well and like, you know, they didn't make that great of money from it or whatever, but for kids with no bills, I mean, we were kind of making equal to our folks. And so we like did really well. So we loved doing it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, I had a leather jacket in junior high. It was, like, freaking rad, you know?
So. The first kid with the Super Nintendo.
Yeah. Well, no, not that. Not no. quite that
okay.
good.
But. Okay. Not that good of money.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that, wow. Okay. So that's where it starts. How yeah. does that morph into, like, composing stuff for Maroon 5?
Well, first of all, I'm arranging for Maroon
5. Oh, okay, okay. arranging. What's the difference?
There is no difference. Okay. It's just whether you get royalties or not is a big difference.
Really?
But, yeah. But I don't want to pull the curtain off of The Wizard of Oz too
no,
far.
No, that's what this show is all about, man.
Okay, well, yeah. you want to talk about that?
I do, yeah. So, I'm totally interested in this type of thing.
There are some people who are really good at the publishing game.
Okay.
And they have really good paperwork, and they make sure that anything that they touch, they get a little piece of the royalties or publishing or whatever.
Which would be considered like a point, right?
Yeah, a point or a writer's share or whatever it is. And there are some people like me who choose not to play that game because they know that at the top level, there's like 20 writers that already have their grubby hands on stuff.
Sure.
So by not trying to greedy grub points and royalties, I end up having a lot of negotiating power as far as what they pay me.
Okay. Okay. So you're getting more of that stuff up front.
Yeah.
Then,
and I get more work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're going to want you back. This guy doesn't really want to like greedy grub our points, which we already have to arm wrestle 18 other people who touched this song, especially in like the pop and hip hop world. So that's like, you know, that's a key element of like, and it's also, you know, I just choose not to play that game when it's something that I write, then I own that.
Yeah.
And I don't share with other people with that.
Yeah.
They can work for me. You know, it goes the other way too. You know, it just depends, you know,
but you're kind of writing this stuff, right?
Yeah.
For, you know, Pink or Maroon 5.
Yeah.
You're writing that
stuff. Well, yes, but I mean, a lot of it's also based on whatever their vocal art is or whatever the guitar part is. So it's kind of like, it's definitely a gray area.
Uh-huh.
Like, there might be a couple notes. Like, if I really want to get greedy and go into it and, like, lawyer up and say, like, well, these two notes are mine. And then they would say, well, but that's based off of our vocal line or whatever. But, you know, there are some things, like the Gym Class Heroes song with Adam Levine that I'm on, the Stereo Hearts, like, they sing a part that is based on the arrangement that I did before they sang it. So it's like, you know, I could say that, like, I wrote that, but I'm not trying to, they paid me fine.
Yeah.
They're repeat customers. It's like, we're all good.
So that wasn't like a source of bad blood for you?
No.
Like when you heard that, like the finished product or something?
I noticed it, but I mean, part of my negotiation with them, with their manager and stuff was like, I was like, hey, cause I'd already done the work. I was like, hey, manager dude, I know that this is going to be a huge hit because I can smell it. And so you guys need to pay me really well. And so he was like, what number can I pay you in order for you to not be heartbroken when you hear this on the radio every 20 minutes? You know, so we came up with a decent number that I felt good about. And then, you know, after it became a number one hit and went multi-platinum, my rates went up.
Yeah.
So it's like, I can't like be bitter about helping my client make lots of money so that my rates could double or triple.
Sure. Well, especially since you're getting, like, they're coming back.
Totally.
They're coming back to you.
That's
and
the
being
thing.
Like, let's work with this guy
That's
again.
That's the thing. They know who made the,
yeah.
the stuff.
Yeah.
They know who, you know, has that,
totally.
You know, tool.
Yeah.
So
you don't foresee yourself like, and this is, I was talking to Chaprice about this exact same thing. In the movie 20 Feet from Stardom, have you seen that with the singers, the backup singers?
It's so funny because my wife was like, I really want to watch this movie. You need to watch it with me. And I was like, did you see that part in Pee-wee's Big Adventure where Dottie was like, Pee-wee, aren't you going to stay and watch the movie? And he was like, I lived it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I said. I was just like, have you seen that part of the Pee-wee's Big Adventure? Because, I mean, I don't care. I don't care what I don't care if it's even close to what I lived
right,
not.
Yeah,
I'm not interested.
Yeah, yeah. But it showed, I mean, it was super interesting for like a layman like myself,
yeah.
right? To see like or find out about, you know, how all that stuff worked out.
Yeah.
With a bunch of these, you know, phenomenal singers that were on some of these amazing records like
yeah.
Rolling Stone and things like that. And then that they, you know, they never really got the glory. Some
yeah.
of them didn't want it. Some
yeah.
of them didn't care.
Totally.
Right? But it seemed like there were a couple people in there that, like, as they got older, they were just like, well, now my shot's long gone.
Right.
You know, and either I'm pissed that I didn't pursue this more with the Rolling Stones
mm-hmm.
or whoever, or, you know, Phil Spector was one of the guys that somebody was miffed at.
Sure.
And
well, I'm sure there's plenty of
there's
reasons.
Plenty of people miffed at that guy. But, excuse me. It was just kind of interesting to see that on film, like
mm-hmm.
somebody being like, yeah, I wish I would have gone back and really fought for myself on, you know, this song. Right.
Well, if you think that that's your one shot, you know, then sure.
Right.
Then maybe you should. But
right.
for me, like, music is like a bag of Doritos. Crunch all you want. I'll make more. Like, I know where it came from, so even, you know...
Did you just make up that analogy? Because that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a dated analogy since they don't use that commercial anymore, but...
Oh, was that a commercial?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was a Doritos commercial from
gotcha.
At least a decade ago, so I'm aging myself. But, you know, it's like... And, you know, even bands that will remain nameless who have... you know, ripped me off or who I feel like owe me something or whatever. It's
mm-hmm.
like, well, you know, have fun taking what you took from me that one time.
Right.
I know how to make that again.
Yeah.
You know, I own all the instruments that you used on your recording.
Yeah.
Like, I, you know, like that kind of thing. Like it's fine. Like
uh-huh.
I'd rather continue working with people and trusting people and not being a greedy grubber with contracts and that kind of BS and get ripped off again
uh-huh.
than to miss out on the amazing people like Chaprice.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And if I was trying to be all paperworky and like greedy grubby about this many points and that kind of thing, like that really stifles the creativity. Like that sucks.
Well, you
then you're
put
keeping
in a
track
lot
like,
of, yeah.
oh, I'm not going to play this many notes because you're
sure.
not paying me for this many notes or whatever. It's like, no, that's not conducive to creativity. You
yeah.
kind of need
yeah.
to put your pride aside and put your like fear of getting ripped off or not getting your fair glory or whatever. You know what? Life isn't fucking fair.
Yeah.
And you know, and the other thing, like, I used to feel more, like, entitled, like, you know, when I was younger, I would see people, like, make it or get some huge record deal, and I'd be like, well, dude, I can do anything they can do, you know, why don't I have, whatever, and I would feel
yeah,
really miffed
yeah.
or entitled, and now it's, like, so obvious, like, oh, because they had a product.
Yeah.
Like... it doesn't matter if you're 20 feet from stardom and you're not the one who put the band together. You don't have the product. You don't have the song. You don't have the merchandise. You don't have this vehicle. Like, then of course you're not, you know, on the center mic. Of course you're not the one with your name on the record or on
mm-hmm.
the billboard or whatever it is. I mean, that's fine. You know, there's an article that I read that actually Shelby Earle turned me on to, and it was an article that said how to be in somebody else's band. It's such a good article.
I read that. Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
I don't agree with every 100% of every aspect of it,
uh-huh.
but overall, the overall tone of it is really good. Like,
yeah.
you know, the person who's putting gas in the tank deserves some respect regardless of what your talent level is.
Right.
In fact,
right.
I kind of get, I kind of like don't somebody, you know, who said, oh, Phil, you're so talented. And I'm like, that's actually not really a compliment because talent is just something that I have. Like, it's not something that like skilled. It's much more of a compliment you're so skilled.
Okay.
Because like, skill is something that I refined, that I worked
that
on.
That you worked on.
Talent is just something you're born with. Mm-hmm. And that's like, it's like saying like, oh, you're, you know, blonde hair is so pretty. And it's like, well, you know, maybe somebody would think that's a compliment, but it's sort of not, because it's just like, I'm kind of just born with blonde hair. Like, it's not, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, so to me, like, talent, like, yeah. I kind of get, like, you're so talented is, to me, is not really a compliment. It's an observation.
I like that.
You know, I'd rather be skilled than talented. Yeah. And I'd also rather be a nice guy. Because I know talented people who are assholes, and I'll never want to work with them.
I've met a lot of them on this show.
Sure. You're sitting across the table from me.
No,
but, you know, like, it is. It's like there's talented people that I totally respect their talent, and they are super gifted, but that has no bearing on what they have done to earn anything or work on their skill or hone their skill or how they treat people or longevity. So, like, you know, talent is just a thing.
Yeah, yeah. I like that. I really do.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to use that in my own life.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Because it makes sense. It's like if you're working on something for years and years, I would love for somebody to tell me, and we do, we get emails sometimes, you know, from people that say, I love your show. I would love for them to say, you know, if they would listen back to some of the first shows of this show are awful. Like, they're bad. They're discombobulated. My thoughts are not there. I'm not good at talking on the microphone. It's something that I've had to work at over 4 years.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Just like the first Tennis Pro show was not good.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. The first time I played in front of a live audience a guitar was awful.
And is so anybody's bad. First band ever good either? No. It's like, I had to be in a couple horrible bands before I figured that out.
Yeah,
and that's
exactly.
Kind of the thing. It's like, I was plenty talented when I was in those horrible bands.
Yeah,
so it's like, where's the rub here? It's like, talent to me, it's like, you can be really talented and have zero taste. You can have, you know, you can totally overplay the hell out of it and like, and wonder why, like, hey, I'm so talented. Why doesn't anybody want me in their band? It's because you can't hear the lead singer because you're wanking all over the place, you know?
Like, that was so, instantly just made me think of my first band in college.
Totally.
Where I was just like, there was two, we had two guitar players and we would solo at the same time.
Right.
It was awful.
Yeah.
Like,
it was bad. Of course you did. Yeah.
Oh, God.
But who hasn't been in that band? I mean,
right,
that's part
of
learning taste and learning that space is just as important as the notes you play.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, that's just part of being a human being and learning, you know.
I'm so constantly embarrassed by my memories.
Well,
you know, do you ever experience that? Like, just think back to when you were, you know, 20 or 19 or 20, and you're in that band where you're soloing at the same time as another guy is soloing, and you're two different guitar players, right? And you're in a bar, and people are standing around. No, like, everybody's about 30, 40 feet away from the stage, and you're just going for it.
Totally.
Right?
Oh, man.
And you feel like you are just A1 motherfucker.
Because you don't know. Because you don't even know.
You think it's going great.
Yeah, because your taste level isn't refined enough yet.
I think back. Oh,
but,
my God. Oh,
well,
I think back on that kind of stuff, and it just makes me cringe. And I'm just constantly thinking about that kind of stuff. I don't know why.
Well, don't beat yourself up. I like to think back and think that that's so long ago, but then if I actually do the math, I'm like, ooh, that wasn't that long ago that I did this and this and this. Okay. Well, we're still learning here. We're still learning.
No, that's right.
And that's the other thing. It's like, you never arrive.
Yeah.
Like, you never make it.
No,
like,
no,
there is no making it.
There is no arrival.
It's always a process
and
a progress. And if, you know, when you stop learning, I guess hopefully you made it at some point before you stopped learning. Because otherwise, and things evolve too.
Yeah.
That's another thing we can talk about. I totally have this theory about, you know, musical style and taste and that kind of thing. You know, the bands that okay, there's a difference between following a trend and evolving musically.
Sure. Yeah.
So the bands that I like, it, not all, but, you know, one thing that I like about a lot of the musical acts that I like is that they'll keep doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And they'll evolve, but they don't ever turn such a sharp corner that they leave their existing audience in the dust.
Yeah.
I really like that about some bands and some artists.
Give me a name a few.
Well, like Sade is, like, you know, tried and true. She's going to continue doing the same type of thing that she knows her audience wants. And it doesn't mean she won't evolve or change. And like even Bjork, or, you know, like Weezer or somebody, they're not going to go so crazy away from what they know their audience's ears, you know. And I like that. I think that that's respectful to your audience. And I think that, you know, evolving is really good. But you want to do it in such a way that you don't leave people in the dust. And also there's another, and I won't name any bands for this, but there are some bands that historically have been just one step behind. And so they keep being like, oh, this is the trend here. We're going to try to make a record like this.
Yeah.
And then 2 years or 1 year later, they're going to make a record like this. And
I will say a band.
And they're never cool because they keep following.
Right. I will say a band that fits that description. I'm not afraid.
Okay, Phil, do it.
I'm not afraid of saying it.
Do it.
Queensryche.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They kind of did that. Maybe Candlebox?
Maybe a little bit.
We're sticking with the Seattle theme here.
If we're doing that.
You know?
When we're off mic, I'll say some other things. I've learned pretty quickly not to shit in the pool.
Yeah, you know, the minute I do that a lot.
The minute I talk smack about somebody, then I meet them and they're like the nicest person ever, and then I feel all bad. And then like, you know, I get some gig where they're my boss, and then I'm like, oh, fuck, I was just talking shit about you. Like,
Oops.
Yeah. I've learned quickly not to do that.
I got to stop doing that too.
It's okay.
I mean, I'm an opinionated person when it comes to music.
I think you're pinning the tail on some pretty safe donkeys at this point.
Right. I don't think Queensryche is listening to this.
And if they are, they probably won't.
I get it. Yeah. By the way, Queensryche, thank you so much for listening
to thanks.
The Air Raid podcast. I really appreciate it.
It was fun opening for you at the Moor a few years ago.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's what I'm saying. You can't shit in the pool, dude.
Ooh, ouch.
Because you have to swim in that pool.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
So you got to be careful.
I do need to be careful. The longer we do this show, the more people that listen around the world. And I find out that I do hurt people's feelings sometimes.
Do you? Do you sometimes get emails of like, I really like Creed and da-da-da.
I've never had one that said that.
Well, yeah.
but I mean, we've gotten emails in the past that some of them don't like the way that we have conducted interviews with certain heroes of some peoples.
Right.
You know,
sure.
That's a real thing.
Sure.
Like, why didn't you ask about this? I was like, well, you try sitting across the table from so-and-so and try keeping your shit straight, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm in front of my hero, Phil Peterson, here, and I'm just trying to come up with shit here, right? Leave me alone.
You're really messing up, dude.
I know. We're cutting all of this out.
I don't know if we can use any of this.
Nothing at all, man. Yeah. But yeah, we do sometimes get, you know, people will say, God, you know, I really like that band and it hurt my feelings when you said that you thought they were tired and awful.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I even like... You know, I didn't like Maroon 5's first record, and I thought I was way too cool for school. And now that they're a client, I'm like...
You're like, oh, this is pretty good.
I have to defend, you know, because they're nice, and he has a great voice. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I have
Phil, he's very talented.
He is very talented.
He's skilled.
I think he's nice. He's skilled. I think he's definitely very skilled.
Yeah, yeah.
So there you go. Yeah.
So, I mean, back on that subject a little bit, like, do you work one-on-one with these groups sometimes? Do you, you know, meet up with them and hash things out? Or is it all online?
One of the reasons why I think I get these gigs is mm-hmm. because I'm not in New York or L.A.
Sure.
And so they trust my musical taste as not being as homogenized as somebody who's like just like in there in the industry, kind of getting inundated with that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, maybe I made some enemies just now on that. but that's a big reason. And then the other reason is because I do my own recording and stuff. I'm saving them days and days and days
sure.
of studio time. Like,
yeah.
My clients don't have time to stop tracking the songs they're tracking to track my string stuff.
Yeah.
Like, they need yeah. me to track it. They need these are the types of projects where, you know, 10 studios are working on the same record at the same time,
mm-hmm.
you know, all across the country. So it's just kind of the normal way that people do it.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
they love it that I'm in Seattle for a taste level thing. And also for it helps my prices for them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, it helps. It just helps the speed because it's like, even if I'm really busy, I'm not crazy booked out like some of the major LA or New York studios or people might be.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So even if I'm super, super busy, I can prioritize, I can make things work.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that's really cool, man. I applaud you for turning this into a career.
It's
not
crazy.
Many people can do that.
It's crazy. It's been a very gradual thing.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. And I mean, do you ever look back? Well, I know we've got to get going here, but
sure.
We'll close out with this. Do you ever look back on what you've done in the last, 15 years? Been doing this for 15, 20 years,
yeah.
you know, on a large scale like mm-hmm. this, and just go, holy crap. Like, I'm on a fucking platinum record.
I'm on three multi-platinum records. And a gold.
And a gold
like,
record.
Like, American Idol used my parts from a Flo Rida song,
oh
like, for
God,
their
that's
commercial.
Right. You did the Flo Rida
like,
thing. Jesus!
And the Lupe Fiasco and Ed Sheeran, like, I'm on a song with both of them, and that felt really crazy when that came out.
Oh, my God. Do you get a copy of these platinum records?
Do you get, I have them on my platinum? Wall. I have them on my wall.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That's my Facebook profile.
Well, I know. I saw that, but I didn't know if you were, like, in somebody else's studio or
no,
something like that.
No, those are mine.
Oh,
I'm
my
not,
God. That's
not
so
a poser.
Cool, man. That is so cool.
I didn't just pose for those. Those
yeah.
are mine. Those yeah. are in my studio.
That's great. So. That is great. So, there is a sense. I'm getting the sense that you have taken a look back and gone.
To some degree.
Whoa.
I mean, it feels good.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, the real desire is kind of that 20 feet from stardom thing though too. It's like, I
sure.
want my project to do something.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
like now that this movie is coming out and people can see it June 5th and June 7th as well,
mm-hmm.
At SIFF, you know, that's going to really be a kind of a moment where I can really stand from this peak and kind of look back and be like, damn, you know,
we accomplished
so,
that.
Yeah. It yeah. feels good.
Well, so. You should be super proud of that movie as well.
Thanks so much.
It's fantastic. Like I said before, I urge you all to go and check out this one. I mean, obviously you have to be in Seattle at the time to see this at SIFF.
It is going to other festival circuits.
Oh, it is.
Though, so
okay.
It played in Sarasota and Eugene and of course South by. So and
okay.
it's doing some other ones too. So
oh, good, good.
Look it up.
Yeah.
Big
Are you
Japan.
Guys traveling along with that kind of stuff?
We went to Eugene and we went to South by.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
And of course we're playing here, but I don't know where else we'll go.
Uh-huh.
We're probably going to go back to Tokyo soon.
Oh, good.
So there's
good.
Some things happening with the self-fulfilling prophecy of the movie. So.
Yeah, yeah. That's great, man. That's so good. Very happy for you guys and your new snowballing success.
Well, thanks so much.
What song should we go out with today?
You could try Rock Over Tokyo, or you could also
Rock
try...
Rock Over Tokyo was the second musical break.
You should play a cover. There's a cover on our soundtrack record called Giggle-Eyed Goo, and it's a 1960s hit. I think it was a hit at number one in Australia in 1966.
Really?
By a band called Steve and the Board. It's called Giggle-Eyed Goo, and we covered it. We got permission and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And, that's pretty rad. And there's also another Steve and the Board song on our record called Now I'm Older. And I guess Maurice Gibb did the backing vocals. And the songwriter from Steve and the Board emailed and he was like, hey, you did a really good job singing Maurice Gibb's part. And I was like, that's amazing. Like,
that's a huge compliment. You know,
that was a huge compliment. I was like, that is so cool. That's Steve one of the coolest board. Thing ever. Yeah.
Oh,
just being told that I did a good job being Maurice Gibb. By the guy that wrote the song.
That wrote the song.
Like, that's a feeling of arrival right
that's
there.
That's better than three platinum, multi-platinum records.
It actually is.
Really?
Well, the platinum records, it is kind of, because it's more, I don't know, like the platinum records just hang on the wall. This is like somebody that I really value's opinion, you know? Like, but I guess the platinum records aren't anyone's opinion. They're sort of like having doctor's degrees
sure.
on the wall.
Yeah, yeah.
They're only way harder to get.
That's a huge accomplishment, man.
Thank you.
That is a huge accomplishment. I'm in awe of your skill.
Well,
sir.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it a lot.
Phil Peterson, thank you so much for coming to the backyard, man. This has been a lot of fun. You can find out more about Tennis Pro by going to tennisproband.com. You guys have got a Twitter and all that stuff as well.
Yep.
Facebook fan page, all that good stuff,
yep,
right?
We do.
Yeah, yeah. So go and check it out. And all the links there are on tennisproband.com. We'll also have the links up on air-raid.net. And remember, you can go to our website and find all the archived episodes, all 100 and what? We're almost at 200. So all, you know, every episode for the last 4 years is there. Please don't listen to the first episode. We covered that in this episode. You don't need to listen to that one. Although it is just don't email me. Just don't tell me that you listen to it. Right? Yeah. Yeah. All the episodes are there. You can listen to Jim Brewer, Bob Saget, Eddie Pepitone, some great comedians and great musicians as well. Mudhoney, Death Cab for Cutie, and Phil Peterson from the band Tennis Pro. Now up there. All right? Do that. All right. This is Giggle-Eyed Goo, and we'll be back next week with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Thanks, everybody.
It swims like a fish and flies like a bird. It wallows like a duck and it's quite absurd. It's positive, negative, natural.